Happy holidays. This is The Takeaway for Monday, December 26, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And for the next hour, we're going to explore this nation's urban intelligence. How resilient are our nation's cities in times of stress, from natural disasters to deep social unrest to keeping themselves financially solvent and capable of supporting public health? Why, what an odd thing, you say. Why do cities have to be resilient? In the movies, L.A. would have to be the most resilient city on Earth for all the times it's been hit by earthquakes, on screen anyway. Or New York, from all those movie meteor strikes, pretty resilient place. But in fact, resilience is fast becoming a key design feature of the modern community. New York City has its own chief resilience officer, for instance. His name is Dan Zarilli. He's also the senior director of climate policy and programs for the city of New York. He oversees New York's preparedness in light of climate change predictions. Zarilli says having someone focused on climate change helps with disaster planning, and it's also a great way for cities with a living memory of disasters to put the lessons they've learned directly into practice.
The way we think about resilience, the definition that we've been using is really that we want to make sure that we're both ready and able to withstand and emerge stronger from the threats of the future. And that could be climate change. That could be any number of threats that are coming our way. Here in New York City, we face a number of threats, of course, and some of those bring opportunities as well. We have a growing population. Our infrastructure is aging. We have growing inequality. And certainly climate change is sitting on top of that as a massive threat that we do face. We've pulled together a program and a set of commitments called One NYC that are designed to address those threats and really build the future for the city that we want to see.
Why doesn't a normal municipal planning department do something like this?
I think what we found is that a lot of these and there's great work that's happening all across our city and our agencies, but many of the concepts, particularly across the climate space, really cut across so many different agencies that it requires a more centralized approach to make sure that we are bringing together and cutting across the silos that exist and bringing a centralized mayor's voice into that conversation.
How do you encourage New Yorkers to be more resilient? Is it a matter of just having stuff in place so that it all doesn't all go to hell when the storm hits? Is it the phones working? Is it having confidence in the emergency procedures, or is it just something internal that has to do with the way people relate to their neighbors?
Well, I think it's a mix of all of that. Our program is really multi-layered, and there's certainly work that we need to do to continue to strengthen neighborhoods, because your neighbors are your first line of defense when something goes wrong, and we need to recognize that and help support that. And with that comes better emergency planning and continuing to improve upon the things that we're doing. It involves really looking hard at the public health impacts that are coming from a climate change. But there are also many things that we as a city need to do, and we're doing that across many different physical areas, and whether it's upgrading our building codes and zoning codes for future threats, adapting our coastline, and certainly working to protect our core infrastructure that serves all of us in times of need and in normal times as well.
How is resilience an antidote to fear?
Oh, I think it helps, because so much – and to take this into the climate perspective in particular, there is so much out there that is apocalyptic in nature on how people are talking about climate and the visuals that you see out there. I think that first, by using the best available science and grounding everything you're doing in facts and data, you can help dispel that that apocryphal notion of what the future might hold and begin to help people understand the kinds of things you can do in your own life to take the steps you can and to help us in city government take the natural steps we need to evolve over time to meet those threats.
Are all cities equally resilient, at least in potential?
You bring up a great question on how do you measure resilience. I wish there was an easy way to say today we're 4 resilient, tomorrow we're going to be 6. But there's really no core way to put numbers behind it. There's an evolving set of metrics that are helping to provide indicators and metrics to this level of thinking. I look at where we are in New York City, and I think we have some fundamental strengths with how we're organized as a city, our size, our ability to adapt, and certainly our people that are able to withstand any number of challenges that we've been able to withstand as a city. I think we have some really strong foundations, but we need to continue doing more if we're going to really be able to address the kinds of things that are coming at us in the future.
What worries you most about the possibility that the Trump administration would not be as interested in active mitigation of climate change as perhaps you and the city of New York is?
We certainly know that the challenges are real. And so we've had a really productive participation and collaboration with the federal government over the last 8 years. Certainly the signs are that we're not going to have anywhere near that level of cooperation. The mayor has been very clear that we've written a letter to the president-elect. We want his participation. We want his help on our fight against climate. But if we don't have that, we're going to have to do things on our own. And we recognize that there's a lot of strength in local government at the state level in order to continue taking action for cleaner energy and for adapting our city for the future. And there's strength that is growing among cities in the region, across the country, and across the globe to come together to really recognize the power that cities have in this conversation. So we certainly would welcome the partnership from D.C. If we're not going to get it, we're going to have to keep going on our own.
What's the worst setback you personally had to face that convinced you you were resilient?
I don't know. I guess I don't try to bring this like into personal setbacks. I really try to think about this through my kids and my family, about what they're going to see in the future, and make sure that we're building a better world for them.
Dan Zarilli, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me, John.
Dan Zarilli is the Senior Director of Climate Policy and Programs and Chief Resilience Officer for the City of New York. New York is part of the 100 Resilient Cities and the first city of the network to complete a resilience plan. 100 Resilient Cities is an initiative pioneered by the Rockefeller Foundation and formed in 2013 to support and fund the work of chief resilience officers in 100 cities around the world. The Takeaway has also received funding from the Rockefeller Foundation for urban resilience reporting. Now to a community on the other side of the U.S. that is solving a utility crisis with some smart planning. In Borrego Springs, the seasonal thirst for power in the summer months has dealt residents high electricity bills and sometimes no power at all as scheduled outages roll across Southern California. But a focus on renewables has meant the community of around 3,400 people has been able to do something few other towns have, and that's get off the grid entirely. Eric Anderson is a reporter for KPBS and has our story.
Borrego Springs sprawls across a mostly flat desert valley that's about 80 miles east of San Diego. Now, the remote location is both an attraction and a challenge.
We are 50 miles from another community that has a big box store. We are 30 miles from the nearest gas station if our power goes out.
That's Linda Haddock, who's lived here about 10 years. She says daytime temperatures can languish above the century mark for long periods during the summer. Haddock says that creates a voracious appetite for power, an appetite that has at times pushed her monthly power bill over $1,000.
Our electric bills soar in the summertime. We live in the desert. Your temperatures, if it's going to be 120 outside, and it's going to be 160 in your car, the ground's 180, it's not going to cool down that much at night.
Haddock lives in a gated resort community of manufactured homes. The electricity that feeds her appliances pulses through a single high-voltage power line that comes from San Diego. That San Diego gas and electric line climbs over a treacherous mountain range. In September 2013, a storm took out 19 SDG&E power poles, severing the town's electrical umbilical cord.
Lightning took them out. It wasn't anything anybody did. Lightning just took out the poles. That's when our monsoon season is. Stuff happens. And we were informed by SDG&E, by this outage, by this issue of trying to get to these poles, get us back up, that it was going to be 3 to 4 days.
An outage that long puts lives here at risk. Utility officials scrambled to get the power back on. They were thinking outside the box when attention turned to a large solar farm on the edge of town. Perhaps it could route power to the community. Rows of photovoltaic panels sit on brackets there several feet off the ground. The solar trees fill the corner of this sun-splashed valley. Neil Bartek's hard hat shields his head from the midday desert sun.
This is a single-axis tracking solar field. The panels are actually tracking the movement of the sun, so right now there's a motor that actually is turning all the panels to be optimally aligned with the sun.
The panels can generate enough electricity to turn on the lights in 26,000 homes. Work crews rerouted the power in 2013 to keep local lights on in Borrego Springs while the power lines were being repaired. That was essentially the birth of the region's microgrid.
What the microgrid allows us to do is to have some resources sourced locally here so that if damage occurs to that line, we can use these local resources to power the community.
But solar isn't the only key to developing a power island like this one. San Diego Gas and Electric added diesel generators to bolster the reliability, and engineers installed a power storage facility. Inside these short white trailers, air conditioners are always on. They keep racks of lithium-ion batteries cool. The utility's Hannon Eisenman says the batteries have a couple of jobs.
What we do with batteries is we store that renewable energy during the day when the sun's out, and then we can release it into the grid in the evening times.
And if a cloud moves over the solar farm and blocks production for a few seconds, the batteries can fill in. That keeps the flow of energy either to the town or the grid steady and predictable.
For customers that need higher degrees of reliability, maybe military, maybe other, hospitals, those kinds of places, maybe communities want that increased reliability, increased use of renewable energy and integration of solar, then it could make sense in those areas.
The University of California, San Diego is bringing that concept into practice.
All right, so what we have here is a 2.8 megawatt fuel cell. Right here is the stacks of the fuel cell, 1.4 megawatts each.
Facilities engineer John Dilliott says the campus has invested heavily in local power. The fuel cell, solar panels, and a cogeneration plant meet more than 90% of the campus's power demand. Most of the power generation decisions were money-saving choices, but Dilliott says that steady, reliable power is crucial here at a major research university.
There are a whole bunch of freezers around campus that store samples of all kinds of stuff at really low temperatures, negative 80 Celsius. And without power, they can hold their refrigeration in there for, a little bit, but not very long.
A lot of that critical research work was put into jeopardy when a Southwestern power outage persisted for hours back in September 2011. Operator error destabilized the grid, and that caused cascading shutdowns in California, Arizona, and Baja California, Mexico. Dilliott says UC San Diego went dark, but the outage was different on campus.
Even though we lost power during the power outage, we were able to restart our generation. They call that black starting. So we did have the ability to do that. And even though the utility was out for 8 to 12 hours, we were only out for about 4 hours.
Blackouts have touched other parts of the country, the Northeast back in 2003, the East Coast during Hurricane Sandy in 2012, and the nation's mid-Atlantic states during another storm that same year. The power grid's age and fragility prompted the Obama administration to launch an initiative earlier this year that actively invests in new grid technologies. Federal officials want to develop a modern power grid that focuses on renewable and flexible power sources. One byproduct could be the creation of even more self-sustaining microgrids. For The Takeaway, I'm Eric Anderson in San Diego.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Last winter was the warmest in the lower 48 states since record-keeping started 120 years ago. That's according to NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Here's some resilience that relates directly to what's on your dinner table. This warming is already having an impact in some places where the idea of a growing season has been distorted and predictions get squishy. The strong El Niño weather pattern is partly to blame, but warmer, shorter winters will be more common as climate change trends continue. As Mose Bouchel reports from member station KUT in Austin, ranchers are some of the first people who have to make some very risky decisions that could determine what ends up on our dinner table.
There's nothing strange about enjoying a good, fresh-picked strawberry.
That is delicious. I just spilled some juice on myself. It's so juicy.
But there is something strange about when and where I was enjoying this one. Marburger Orchard is in Fredericksburg, Texas. Gary Marburger's main business is peaches. He keeps berries for the off-season. And this year, it was the way off-season. I visited Marburger in February, early for berries, even in Texas.
And we're seeing them much earlier this year than we ever have. Normally, we would just now maybe be getting started, and we already started a month ago this year.
That's because this winter, the farmer took a gamble. Betting on fewer frosty nights, he started tending his plants early.
And then still, it's a gamble. You can go ahead and do it, and then the forecast isn't correct, and then again, you've wasted and put a lot of time and effort into it.
But walking through well-maintained rows of berries, you can see it paid off.
And you can see them in all stages. We're looking here at all the way from bloom to little green ones to bigger green ones, and then eventually they start showing some red on them.
He says in his 35 years farming the Central Texas Hill Country, it feels like winters just don't get as cold as they used to, and he may grow more early crops in years to come. He probably won't be alone, says Norma Fowler. Fowler is a professor at the University of Texas at Austin who specializes in plant biology.
There's actually getting to be quite a scientific literature, quite a collection of scientific studies where people have actually documented that things are happening earlier in the spring.
And, of course, it's not just in Texas. In California, some wine growers may move further north, while others change the type of grapes they grow. In New England, the apple harvests are at risk. Fowler says some things that require cold winter nights will be harder to plant.
On the other hand, you might be able to grow something now that you couldn't have grown 20 years ago.
Like strawberries in the winter. This disruption is also not limited to plants.
We have more dust, which can create some respiratory problems.
Heat stress on the animal will affect their production.
The sows aren't comfortable, and so they just don't perform as well.
This is from a video called Climate Change Impacts on Animal Agriculture. It's part of a USDA project to get ranchers, hog, and poultry farmers prepared for global warming.
And it addresses some of the adaptation strategies and approaches that producers are already using in different parts of the nation.
David Smith is a program specialist at Texas A&M University. He works in the project here in the southwestern region where there's a lot of cattle. One way climate change threatens cattle is with warmer summer nights. That leads to heat stress.
What happens is that they stop producing as much milk.
Beef cattle don't eat as much, so they don't gain weight.
They have more reproductive issues.
They have a lot more health problems in general.
Just simply because they can't recover. They can't dissipate that heat that they've retained during the day.
Smith says ranchers are eager to confront the challenge. They're buying cooling systems, even breeding cattle to withstand higher temperatures. Where he runs into resistance is when he links changes in climate to the science of climate change. In Texas, a lot of the people who feel the most immediate impacts of global warming are still skeptical that man plays a role.
There's some regions in the country that are more open to the discussion. Example, up in Washington State, they frequently have climate change workshops.
Here, Smith needs to be a little more creative. He can raise a lot of the same issues without mentioning the C word. One example, his last workshop was on the water, energy, food nexus.
Because if we would have put on a climate change workshop, we probably wouldn't get very many folks at the table.
But that could be changing. A recent Gallup poll shows a record number of Americans believe human activity is causing climate change. Back at Marburger Orchard, I conducted a survey of one. I posed this question to farmer Gary Marburger.
You know, I don't know what your feelings are on climate change. Do you think that's happening? Or
I don't think I'm in a position to say that. And one year can be so drastically different from the next year, and it's up and down. So you know you're looking more at average for overall. And my gut feel is it seems like, and the overall average seems to me like it's that we're getting into a little bit milder winters than we've had in the past.
He said when he started out 35 years ago, he used to plant a specific variety of peach tree that does better in colder winters. But he wouldn't dream of planting that kind anymore. The winters just seem too warm for it now. For The Takeaway, I'm Mose Bouchel, member station KUT.
Moses Report is part of a collaboration between member stations KPBS in San Diego, OPB in Portland, WDET in Detroit, and KUT in Austin. What do you think of the resilience of your neighborhood? What do you love about it? What needs to work better? Austin, Texas. I love our clean, cool spring in the heart of Austin, and the community has to better protect it from pollution and doom. Morristown, New Jersey. I grew up in Patterson. I love that everywhere I looked, I saw people like me. I heard people like me and by me. I mean Latino. I did not know the feeling of being a minority until I went to Rutgers University, which is also one of the most diverse universities in the nation. What needs to work better is the growing amount of crime. The city is constantly in the news for shootings, muggings, no relief in sight. I love my neighborhood of Ravinia in Highland Park, Illinois. It has big oak trees that shade the yards and sidewalks, an elementary school, easy walks to the beach on Lake Michigan, small business district with restaurants and shops, a train station to take you to downtown Chicago, and in the summertime, world-class Ravinia Festival, summer home of the Chicago Symphony. Bragging there, Ravinia. Well, you're free to brag. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And remember, if you love us, subscribe to the Takeaway podcast on iTunes or anywhere you get your podcasts, and give us a review. Any review will do, but a good one is twice as nice.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. The majority of U.S. cities had electricity by the 1930s, but that wasn't the case in rural parts of the country, places built with the assumption of isolation. And one of the most historically significant examples of forward planning and built-in resilience was the creation of the electrical grid for rural America. President Roosevelt was convinced by some forward-thinking lawmakers, including Lyndon Johnson of Texas and Washington's Warren Magnuson, to set up the Rural Electrification Authority. The federal government would deliver the power, while public co-ops would manage distribution, using government subsidies and rural cooperatives to bring electricity to areas that private utility companies said were too expensive to supply. Well, that locally owned grid is now the model for bringing fiber optic cable to rural America for delivering the internet. Christopher Mitchell is the director of community broadband networks at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Well, I like to think of this in historical terms, and I'd say that I have no doubt we are going to make sure that everyone has high-quality internet access. We brought electrification to everyone, not just using co-ops, but don't forget, this was the Depression, it was World War II, it was challenging times. And we figured that out. Now we have the poles from electrification. We have these great organizations, and they're well-equipped to pivot, make sure that every home could have a high-quality internet access connection.
And the infrastructure is there, or there would have to be a lot of capital investment here?
Oh, there would definitely need to be a lot of capital investment, but we're not talking about an unreasonable amount. And frankly, when we think about the expense, we should also be thinking about the amount we've already been spending on subsidizing ineffective services. So, you know, I think the proper word for what we've been doing to subsidize AT&T, CenturyLink, some of these big carriers would be shoveling money at them. And they've been reluctant to invest in those rural areas because they don't see a lot of profit there. So it would make more sense in my mind to find ways of encouraging the electric co-ops, which are represented by those people in those communities. You know, they're very locally accountable, making sure that they are the ones that are able to do this. We've seen about 40 of them already step up.
Is there goodwill left over from the Depression era that these co-ops rely on that actually gets consumers involved in a way that they might be maybe a little more suspicious of private companies?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, it's interesting to use the term consumers. I think, you know, member owners is the nomenclature that they like to use because they don't see themselves as just consumers. They get dividends when the co-ops do well. They vote on the board of the co-op. So they're very active in managing it as well. But there's a lot of goodwill. And, you know, some states have an incredible cooperative tradition. But even states that don't still have a number of co-ops, and people are familiar with the concept. And I think they know that when they're voting on the board, that that organization is going to put their needs first. They're not going to be, you know, sending call jobs to call centers out in the Philippines or to South Carolina if you're in Iowa, for instance. They're going to be investing locally. They're going to keep the prices manageable. They're going to keep investing in new services. And so they really trust that local ownership, I think.
Chris, you know, this sounds a lot like socialism, I have to say.
Well, it's interesting because I think cooperatives came out of the socialist movement, and yet a cooperative is a private entity. And when the alternative might be local governments investing as a last resort, which will happen often, we see that very conservative people tend to really love co-ops. And, you know, when it comes down to local governments investing, I'll just throw out there that most of the local governments that have gotten involved in this are actually in very conservative areas of the United States. But fundamentally, when you're talking about this kind of level of infrastructure, people are putting aside ideology and they really want to figure out how to make it work. You know, at a certain point, you just need internet access. You know, suddenly, whether or not something looks like it came out of socialist ideas 100 years ago, that isn't a very big deal.
Christopher Mitchell is director of community broadband networks at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thank you.
Here's another kind of resilience. Earlier this year, the city of Portland was baffled to find elevated levels of cadmium, a heavy metal that can cause cancer in the air. Where was it coming from? Well, researchers in Oregon set out to investigate, and what they found was almost as surprising as how they found it. Cassandra Profita from member station OPB in Portland takes us there.
Forest Service researcher Sarah Javon barely has to walk two blocks from her office in downtown Portland to find a shaggy patch of dark green tree moss. It grows all over the city.
You can even just see it from here, these trees. You can see the big, dark blotches. Basically, that's the moss. You could see it across the street. All these trees on the street here.
Javon is a lichenologist. That is, she studies moss and lichen.
So for a sample, probably you'd need maybe, you know, a couple handfuls.
To test it for pollutants, scientists grind up the moss, liquefy it, and run it through a machine that measures contaminants. Because moss gets all of its nutrients from the atmosphere, it's a natural air pollution monitor, as Forest Service economist Jeff Donovan found out.
And until we got into this, I was kind of assumed that we knew what was in our air, but we actually know very little.
Donovan and Javon wanted to see if moss testing could help regulators track down the source of the city's extra cadmium pollution. Together, the researchers gathered more than 300 moss samples across the city. Then they reviewed the results.
We go and we look at the heavy metal data, you know, and we open up the data sheet. But then we see these two big hotspots, I mean, really big hotspots. So one in southeast Portland and one in north Portland.
They overlaid the cadmium hotspots with a map of known sources of cadmium pollution, expecting them to match up.
And they didn't. And they didn't at all. And that's where the mystery started.
So where was the cadmium coming from? As they searched for other possible sources, they made a startling discovery. The levels of cadmium in the moss samples clearly pointed to the culprits. The two hotspots were right around two companies that make artistic stained glass.
We're looking at these things thinking, wow, we didn't see this one coming. I mean, most people don't think stained glass manufacturers as sort of evil polluters. You know, you don't think of that at all. It was surprising, certainly.
Stained glass makers use cadmium to make their red, orange, and yellow colors. But they aren't required to use pollution controls or test their emissions. So regulators didn't know how much cadmium they were releasing. The levels were particularly alarming around bullseye glass. There, the moss also revealed a hotspot for arsenic, another metal used in glassmaking.
I was furious. I was honestly so mad.
Sarah Livingstone lives a few blocks from Bullseye. Weeks before officials announced the hazardous hotspots, she had rushed to the ER, unable to breathe. She was diagnosed with pneumonia and pleural effusion. She didn't have a reason to blame air pollution until she heard the news.
And, you know, my understanding is that both arsenic and cadmium can really wreak havoc on the lungs, especially cadmium.
State officials put an air monitor near Bullseye. The levels of cadmium and arsenic they found were unprecedented, high enough to cause cancer. Based on the moss findings, Oregon officials are rewriting state air pollution rules. Two Portland glassmakers will be required to install pollution controls, and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is investigating stained glass companies across the country. But the whole ordeal has left many wondering what other toxic air pollution regulators are missing. Why aren't we taking more moss samples?
They're really showing us things that we haven't been able to detect before.
Vivek Shandas is an urban planning professor at Portland State University. He says because air testing is so expensive, it's normal for regulators to test just one location per city.
We only know really at a very general level across the metropolitan region what the air quality is like. We're missing a lot, though I would have to add, I'm not surprised.
Shandas hopes more moss testing can fill in the gaps in what we know about air pollution. We're not quite at the point where we can just test moss instead of putting up air monitors. Javon and Donovan with the Forest Service say they still need to do more research to convert moss test results directly into air quality measurements. But, they say, that's the dream. For The Takeaway, I'm Cassandra Profita, member station OPB.
Want more information about the stories you hear on The Takeaway? Check out thetakeaway.org for more facts, figures, and news from guests and contributors and opinions from your fellow listeners. You can also check out the latest John Hockenberry blog post and subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a note or comment on a story you heard, all at thetakeaway.org.
When the city of Detroit emerged from this nation's largest ever municipal bankruptcy 2 years ago, it was left with a razor-thin financial cushion, but also some terrific incentives to attract new businesses downtown. And now Detroit's downtown is booming, with new construction everywhere. But some longtime residents, primarily African Americans, fear that the investment isn't really about them. It's geared only to attract upscale white millennials. And now Detroit officials are weighing how much of the city's scant resources should be dedicated for the city's outlying and mostly abandoned neighborhoods. WDET's Quinn Kleinfelter has more.
Detroit is huge, 139 square miles. At its height in the 1950s, the Motor City had almost 2 million residents. Now, after decades of lost manufacturing jobs and at times outright public corruption, Detroit has a population of less than 700,000. One of the most desolate and dangerous neighborhoods is called Brightmoor.
And then we're going to the park to go to the party, okay?
Yet on the front porch of a modest single-family home, Dawn Wilson Clark sits in a pocket of hope, one of hundreds of homes built about a decade and a half ago to push back against the overwhelming blight.
And actually, my ex-husband was not happy about this location. I told him, don't worry about it. They're going to tear that house down. They're going to tear these houses down. And in 10 years, the neighborhood is going to be different. And we're going to be a part of that. He didn't agree, and he's gone. And I'm still here with a wonderful new husband who is helping me be a part of the change.
Dawn says she has to drive her children miles away from Brightmoor so they can attend decent schools. But she also says her kids have had positive entrepreneurial and artistic experiences in Brightmoor she doubts would happen anywhere else in the city. She wonders if Detroit officials will consider that when they determine how much service to provide to the mostly decayed area.
I just hope residents are at the table when those decisions are being made. We have endured the blight, the turmoil, the gunshots, the crime, but we've stayed in our communities because we want it to be there. We need to have a voice.
City officials say that message has been received.
All these neighborhoods have a future. They don't all have the same future.
Maurice Cox is Detroit's chief city planner. He came here after helping guide the rebuilding of flood-ravaged New Orleans following Hurricane Katrina. But Cox says in many ways the situation in Detroit is worse.
One of the challenges that Detroit has is because it's so large, whenever you invest in the public realm, you can barely see it because often it's spread so thinly. And where investors see the public resources, they tend to gravitate.
Yet Cox says the mostly vacant outskirts offer a unique opportunity.
We can go in and green 20 acres. Like, how many neighborhoods in America can you go in and do that? And then actually employ people from that neighborhood as a part of the green collar workforce. And then on the flip side, you know, we have probably the largest inventory of historic structures that are available for reuse in the country.
Cox vows that Detroit will continue providing water, electricity, and police protection to all neighborhoods, even those that are desolate. But he predicts that will become increasingly unnecessary as rebuilding continues in Detroit communities that are beginning to thrive.
So if you have a chance to live in a neighborhood where you can walk within 20 minutes of your house to grocery, fresh produce, greenways, quality schools, or you can live in an area where you don't have many neighbors anymore, the services are inadequate, you know, where would people rather live?
Some folks in Detroit, which remains mired in high rates of poverty and unemployment, don't have the luxury or the financial ability to move to more choice neighborhoods. Experts say those people won't have to move if their current communities can be repurposed.
This one over here. It's not just planting flowers, but these actually have environmental attributes to them.
At a kind of think tank called Detroit Future City, Executive Director Annika Goss Foster points to a map of projects she says are flourishing in impoverished neighborhoods that are proving unexpectedly resilient.
The view of the city was very black and white. The city's too big, so we need to shut it down, right? I think now we're viewing those communities very differently. Let's think about how we might use vacant land for a solar array to reduce energy efficiency. You need large acreage for that. Let's think about the land for community farming.
In fact, some researchers view that barely occupied land as a living laboratory for testing urban revitalization. Even pieces of wood left over from homes that have been demolished are sometimes reused as a part of a new home. Miles away, in some ways worlds away, from those neighborhoods, Detroit's downtown is humming with construction work, a huge sports arena complex, a commuter rail line. For a motor city that touts itself as having put the world on wheels, Detroit has almost no public transportation. City officials are trying to bridge a decades-old battle with their suburban counterparts and create a regional transit authority. But all of that seems very far away back in Brightmoor. On her front porch, surrounded by her children, Dawn Wilson Clark wonders if they or her neighborhood truly have a place in Motown's future.
You need to realize that people matter, not just the big business and not just people coming in, moving into this new fancy hip Detroit. You need to take care of the people who've been taking care of the city.
Detroit officials say they meet often with community leaders as they decipher where best to use the city's financial resources, but they add that they must increase Detroit's tax base if they hope to afford the way forward. And that means attracting new residents who, officials say, will in all likelihood want to move to a city with a vibrant urban atmosphere, not neighborhoods filled with the debris of the past. For The Takeaway, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter in Detroit.
There's lots more of our urban resilience reporting. All you have to do is visit thetakeaway.org/urban resilience. What do you think about this idea of resilience? You think your city and neighborhood are resilient? Tell us what you love about it, what needs to work better. Texas. I live in Jarrell, Texas, outside of Austin. I like that there is rarely traffic out here, but that's about it. Parents don't participate in school activities. This is a food desert. No sidewalks, no library, no community center. The bus that comes here takes one trip Wednesday at 7 a.m. and it comes back at 4 p.m. And it is a commuter town with a Dollar General. Olympia, Washington. The people are generous, creative, and trusting, but there is a scourge of greedy developers tearing down historic homes and landlords enforcing no-cause evictions in order to sell their lots to developers. It's ruining neighborhood character and destroying affordable housing, and many good people are forced to move out of the city.
My name is Liz Ritter. I live in Washington Heights, New York City. I love that our neighborhood banded together with a coalition of community groups and the local community board in partnership with our elected officials to save our local supermarket from closing and being replaced by a big box chain drugstore. and we still have our neighborhood supermarket. Margaret Mead was right. Never doubt that a small, committed group of citizens can change the world.
We're going to end this hour remembering an icon in the world of urban planning, urban theorist and planner Jane Jacobs, who first observed the innate intelligence of cities and spotted the ways in which they could be resilient. Jacobs actually recruited Margaret Mead, among others, in the 1950s and 60s when she led the resistance against developer Robert Moses and his plans to level neighborhoods in lower Manhattan in exchange for an expressway. Jacobs insisted that the best measure of the health of a city was how it works at the street level.
If people get fond of their district, their neighborhood, and stay there, and if the city is working the way it should, they begin to get connections in the next generation to get better educations and so on. And all of this is reflected in the neighborhood.
Sustainable development, Jane Jacobs argued all of her life, is a nurturing quality of life in the heart of the city, in the neighborhoods. To old hands in the city of New York, this concept is not so new. It's just another way of thinking about change. Roberta Brandes Gratz is an urban planner, founder of the Center for the Living City, and she's the author of We're Still Here, You Bastards, How the People of New Orleans Rebuilt Their City.
It's always a moment to think about change and things happening that are changing. The fundamentals don't change, though. The new flavor of the moment might make people think that there's all sorts of change happening that is momentary. I think there is a major difference today because technology is certainly playing a role that it hasn't in a long time. But I'm amused to look back at the time when the cell phone was the newest thing and everybody said, well, between cell phones and computers, cities will just be an anachronism. We won't need them anymore. And yet the first thing that happened when computers came out and cell phones, and mostly computers, was the internet cafe. People need people. And that's what cities are about. And whatever technology you embrace, you're not going to lose, or you shouldn't lose, the essence of a city, which is the interconnection of people and place.
What would Jane Jacobs think about the Smart Cities Initiative and the idea that technology is going to reclaim some of this territory taken by cars?
Well, first of all, it's always dangerous to try to assume what Jane Jacobs would say. Although we did have discussions about some of this before she died, it was never at this point. First of all, her whole notion was regain the city for transit and for feet, not for cars. And she used to say she wasn't against cars. She was against remaking the city to accommodate cars. And that if people chose the inconvenience of sitting in traffic in their car, that was their choice. But don't ask us to give up what makes the city urban to be accommodating to the car. And she was very articulate in how when we fought over Westway, that Westway was about trading in the money for transit, not expanding our capacity to bring in new vehicular traffic.
Westway, the imagined interstate highway that would be on the west side.
Yeah, the 12 lanes of traffic that would have been, you know, partially underground and landfill and all that stuff on the far west side, which would never have happened as it was planned anyway. But the important, and I had a whole chapter based on interviews with her in my Battle for Gotham book, it was very clear that the trade-in, which happened under duress, Mayors Koch and Governor Carey traded in Westway for transit funding. At the 11th hour, that funding was going to cease. And that trade-in was the beginning of the rebuilding of the New York City transit system and the region. And it has, you know, been amazing what has happened in our transit system. And that's been the lifeblood of the city. I have friends who have lived in Brooklyn for decades who will tell you that they could never get home. They could never get to and from the city in a reasonable way until the transit system was reborn. And now look at Brooklyn. Look at Queens. Look at the Bronx. It's amazing because the growth and the positive change has been able to spread.
What do you think of the technology, the wired and data collecting city that suddenly will have its tryout in Hudson Yards and extend elsewhere in the city where there are already cameras all over the place?
You know, I don't know that it will actually change urbanism. Urbanism is still about people, not about devices. And we're caught in that moment of excitement. There will be a lot of advantages, you know, probably access to all sorts of things will be great. But, you know, our technology is making us more of a divided society than ever. It's access to the technology that defines us and differentiates people who have access and people who don't have access. But the fundamentals of a city, the fundamentals of urbanism are not going to change.
What would you caution would be the Jane Jacobs sort of warning and lesson that we should take with us 100 years after?
Don't think that cities can be reduced to data and efficient technologies. One of the fundamental problems with planning years ago was it was always based on data, not on people. We are a people-oriented society, and that's what city is about. And I think if Jane taught us one thing, it was to observe and to understand through observation and through people and people, not through people and technology.
Roberta Brandes-Gratz is an urban planner. She's the founder of the Center for the Living City and author of We're Still Here, You Bastards, How the People of New Orleans Rebuilt Their City. Thank you so much.
Good to be here.
And here's a little something to take with you today. Every year since Hurricane Sandy hit New York in 2012, I'm reminded of resilience as the Red Hook Rebirth Parade noisily and joyfully wanders by my window. Down by the water, residents of Red Hook took a big hit in that storm. We all had to learn self-reliance and how to rely on each other. My then 3-year-old son's first Halloween was obliterated by Sandy, and each year his anxiety about a Halloween disaster coming is there on his face, but it's been fading. And this year we were watching the Red Hook Rebirth Parade, and my still little 7-year-old said to me, "I guess Sandy didn't destroy the holiday, Daddy." "You mean Halloween, Ajax?" I asked him. "Yes, we still have Halloween, and we've got our own parade, too." He's right. The neighborhood came back better than before, ready for next time, and we discovered we had more than a decent amateur brass band right in our midst. That's resilience. I'm John Huckenberry. Happy holiday to everyone out there. Thanks so much for listening. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.